I like those good AA welcomes. Thank you. My name is Marcy White, and I'm a grateful, blessed, recovering Al-Anon.
Hi, Marcy.
I have 45 years in Al-Anon this year. You know, I don't think I know as much as I did way back there. Do you feel that way? I have been trying to think, what do I leave out and what do I say? And I want to tell you a little bit about my husband, Bob, because he is the reason that I came to Al-Anon, and he is the one that I was with 29 and a half years of his sobriety. So I don't want to dwell too much on that, but I did want to tell you that before I ever married Bob, my father was an alcoholic, and he needed Alcoholics Anonymous, and there wasn't one. And my mother needed Al-Anon, and there wasn't an Al-Anon. And I needed Alateen, and there wasn't Alateen. So it's especially meaningful to me to get to know about the Alateen program and to get to help with that, as I was the Al-Anon delegate, as well as Al-Anon, and to watch Al-Anon come of age. When I got into Al-Anon, it wasn't named Al-Anon. They hadn't named it yet. And there wasn't a book. And we read the big book in our meetings, but we didn't think about applying it to us. We were reading it to understand the alcoholic. And a year after I was in Al-Anon, the Al-Anon book came out in St. Louis, Missouri, at the big AA conference there. It was the last year that Dr. Bob was alive, and that Al-Anon book came out. And so at least we had one book. But I read the One Day at a... What do you call that? 24-hour book. I read that every day. And I read the big book. So actually, I learned from the AAs. And I asked them questions, and they were my teachers. And then when I learned enough, then I turned around and gave it to Al-Anon. And if I hadn't had that, I don't think I would have stayed. Would you have stayed now? There wasn't anything there for us, was there? Not much. But it's great to see that Al-Anon has come of age, and how wonderful Al-Anon is in this part of the country and Texas. Back to Bob. Bob drank from the time we were married, but of course I didn't know he was an alcoholic because he didn't drink like my father did, and I didn't even know my father was an alcoholic. I just thought he was crazy. And I began to think that Bob was crazy too, because I remember one time we lived in Denver. We had already had the geographical cure, he thought, and we were living in Littleton, Colorado, and he didn't come home very much. He was a running drunk, and he'd be gone 2-3 weeks, maybe months at a time. But he was home, and I walked into the bedroom to go to bed, and he was sitting on the side of the bed, and he was dressed, but I think he was trying to get undressed and go to bed, but he was pretty drunk. And he had gotten me up several nights to turn off that music, and I never could turn the music off. I didn't know what he was talking about. But this night, to show you how sick I was, he was entertaining a group of people in the bedroom, and he was talking to them. And he asked me to serve them drinks. And I said, well, who are they? Well, so-and-so's here. And he pointed them all out to me. And, you know, I served them a drink. I would just, here's your drink, and here's your... I gave everybody an imaginary drink, and he was just as happy as he could be because I served all his buddies a drink. And I knew there was something the matter with him, but I did not know it was alcoholism. It was shortly after that I went with him way up in northern Colorado on a buying order. He was supposed to be working for an oil company and buying leases. And there were two people that stayed in a motel next door to us that they'd never seen him before. But they saw him with his bottle. He was drinking straight out of the bottle then, and he would sit with the telephone and take a snort and drink some more. And they came up to me and said, did you know your husband's an alcoholic? I did not know what to say. And I said, well, I kind of thought that maybe he might be on the barter. If he doesn't straighten up, he might be one. And they just laughed at me, and they told me they would send me some literature, which they didn't. I looked for it for a month in the mailbox. But they told me some things that he would start doing. If he hadn't already started doing them, he would start doing them. And one of them was that he would start sneaking drinks. I said, oh, he won't sneak drinks. He just keeps his bottle on the kitchen counter, and he just goes and drinks it whenever he wants to. They said, we don't care. He will sneak drinks from you because he doesn't want you to know how much he's drinking, and he doesn't even want to know how much he's drinking. And then the other thing they told me was that he would start having, if he didn't already have them, he would start having blackouts. And the other thing I don't remember that they told me, but all three of those things they told me I watched happen. We went back to Midland one time at Christmas time. Our twins were ill and couldn't travel back with us when we went, so I stayed there with the twins and had him take our older daughter Sandy back with him. But I was trying to get him a ride back, and so we went over to these friends' house that day, and I was determined that he wasn't going to drink that day because he had to leave the next day and drive Sandy back to go to school. And I told him, you cannot drink today, and I stayed with him all day to watch him. Well, I found out that his brother J.M. was on the wagon, but he went out to see him, and he went out to talk to the guys that worked for him, and I found out later from J.M. that he drank beer out of their icebox. I didn't know it. He was sneaking drinks. And then we went to see these other people that were going to, guy Jay was going to drive Bob to, I believe, to Colorado with Sandy. And they asked us if we would have a drink, and I said, no, we're not going to drink today. And they said, oh, if we just did a half a jigger. So Bob had one with a half a jigger. And then I started looking for him, and I couldn't find him. And I walked in the kitchen, and here he was, just guzzling. So I knew he was, all three of those things I saw happen. As soon as they told me, it was not over a month until I saw him happen. So then I knew he was an alcoholic. But they didn't tell me anything about Al-Anon. There wasn't any Al-Anon. So I didn't think there was a place for me unless he went into AA, and then I could go with him. So that was the beginning of the end for me, because I knew he was an alcoholic. I knew that he didn't want to quit drinking, and I knew that I couldn't go on that way. And so that was the beginning of the end. That was the thing that made me decide I gotta leave. So I did leave. He was gone. He was on that 3-month drunk. And so I just left while he was gone, and moved home with my mother and father, sold some furniture that we had already hocked to be able to get enough money to rent a truck to drive to Texas. And the rest of the stuff, I just left with this man if he would take up the payments and keep paying out furniture. So I got home to my mother and father. And now, in the meantime, I had written a letter to his parents and told them the truth, and that I had lied to him and pretending he was okay and he wasn't, and that he was an alcoholic and I couldn't live that way anymore, and they could have him back. I didn't want him anymore. And I meant it. And the very day that I get to my mother and father's house, instead of being in Meridian with his family waiting to go to Menninger's clinic like I thought he was going to do, He was in Midland, and he called and wanted to see me, and he was the last person I wanted to see. But I don't know about you, but he could always talk me into doing about anything he wanted me to do. And I let him come out, and we had a visit. To my utter amazement, he told me he had been sober 6 weeks in AA, and some people in Midland heard about him, and they made a 600-mile round trip from Midland to Meridian, Texas, to carry him the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they stayed 3 nights and 2 days and took him to his first meeting and told him that he had to go at least once a week. His family did not trust him with a car. They hid all the keys from the cars. They lived on a farm. They even hid the Jeep keys. And they drove him 40 miles to Waco once a week to a meeting and sat in the car and waited while he went to his meeting and gave him $1 to put in the plate. And that's the way he started AA. See, I didn't know any of this when I saw him 6 weeks later, but he told me that his sponsor, Henry, said, if you want to make a good 12-step call, just go back to Midland and walk the streets of your hometown sober. And that's a good way to do a 12-step call. So they had sent him back to Midland while he was on the waiting list getting Miniger's Clinic. And so he was going to AA. And all he said that day was, "You don't have any business trying to live here with your mother and father with 3 children, and I have a job, and I will give you enough money that you can have an apartment." So I took him up on his offer and left him out and rented a 2-bedroom apartment, and it was Sandy and I slept in one room and twins slept in the other. And he would go to the meetings, and every now and then one of his AA friends would call me and tell me how well he was doing. And they all wanted to get me to a meeting, but I didn't want to go. You know why I didn't want to go? I was afraid they would talk me into taking him back, and I didn't want to take him back. You're pretty good at that, you know. And I got good at it, too. But I didn't like the way I was treating Henry and the other guys and Fillmore. And I was kind of frozen inside, and I was different than I used to be. And I pushed the hurt and the pain down, and I didn't have any way to let it out. And I just decided I'm not going to have any more of that. But one day, and I never saw a wife of an alcoholic. They didn't call me or anything, but one day Henry called and asked if I would come to dinner. And I said, "Well, yes, I think I could do that." And he said, "Well, Bob's coming too. Is it all right if he picks you up?" And I said, "Well, that's okay. We are on speaking terms." So Bob picked me up and took me to Henry and Anna Merle's. And the 3 men that made that 600-mile round trip 12-step call were there with their 3 wives. And I was impressed. And I needed to be impressed. I was one of those people that wanted everything just so-so, and the white linen tablecloth was on, and the china was on the table, and the silver was on the table. And I was impressed because I thought alcoholics slept under park benches, and I just didn't have any idea that alcoholics live that way. I didn't know the difference in a sober alcoholic and a drunk alcoholic. And I found myself having a good time with these people. And after we finished dinner, they said, "By the way, we're all going to a meeting. Wouldn't you like to go?" That was the last thing I wanted to do, was go to a meeting. But I did have some protocol and some manners, and I had had dinner with them, and so I said, yes, I would go to the meeting. That's the only way I would have gotten there. I remember reading the 12 steps on the wall and thought, well, aren't those nice? That's about as far as I got with them. But I liked the way I felt, and I liked the way they treated me. And the main thing was, I didn't have to lie anymore. I didn't have to pretend. I could be myself. I could be honest. And I knew that from the very first meeting. Now, I didn't go anymore because I didn't want him. When he took me back to the apartment, he said, "May I come up and talk to you?" And I said, "Okay." And I did not even know what he was doing. I know today he was making amends to me. He was working his program, but I had no idea what he was doing, but he was nicer than he'd ever been. And he was telling me all of these things that he had done that he was sorry for. And after he told me all that he could remember, and he couldn't remember all of them, you know, then he said, "Is there anything else?" And boy, I let him have it with both barrels. And to my utter amazement, he wasn't yelling and I wasn't crying. And I realized this is the first time we've communicated in years. Then after that part was over, then he told me the things that I had done that he didn't like. Now, he had set the tone for that, so I sat and listened. And I didn't defend myself, I just listened. And what we were doing, we were wiping the slate clean of a marriage that didn't work, that never had worked and couldn't work. And we were going to build anew on a firm foundation. And that would have had to have happened to us before we could have ever made it together. Because I was determined that that was it and I was through. So I would say probably after 2 or 3 months, he asked me one day, would I be willing to try it again? And I'd softened up just about that much, just a little bit. And I said, yes, I will. We have 3 children. And I could already see that this was the first chance we had had to really make the marriage work. But I said, it's going to be under one condition. Now, this is not Al-Anon. This is my story I'm telling you. Al-Anon doesn't tell you to do this, but this is what I did, and there wasn't any Al-Anon to tell me. So I did it from my heart, from my gut, the way I felt. And I said, okay, we'll try it again. But you need to understand, one drink, and you're out. I cannot handle any more of your drinking. And the AA thought I was terrible. But I want to tell you, he never had another drink. I don't know whether that had anything to do with it. But I saw him go through some things that I believe if he would have drank if he was going to. And these AA was sidle up to me and say, you know what you told Bob when you went back to him, that if he had one drink, he was out? And I said, yeah, I remember. And they said, you didn't really mean that, did you? And I said, yes, I did. And I still do. And I think it was years. Well, I think I always meant it. And I think he knew I meant it. And there just wasn't an option as far as I was concerned. He'd used up all his options. So when we went back together, I was going to Al-Anon. We didn't call it Al-Anon. And I remember I would say in the family wives group meetings, we would read the big book. And I would hold up my hand. When is he going to get okay? When is he going to quit doing this? And they said, just keep on coming to the meetings. Just keep on coming back. And it took me a long time before I realized that it takes a long time to rehabilitate. You don't rehabilitate in a month or two. And then it takes longer than that to habilitate and be better than you were before you ever started drinking. I had a very wise man that was in AA tell us that one time. And I learned from the AAs. And I had some wonderful teachers. One of them was a guy named Horace Fort. He's passed on to the big meeting years ago. But he was the one that came every 3 months, and I would save up all of my questions till Horace got there. And I'm sure he thought they were such silly questions, but he was so kind and patient, and Bob would save them up too. And I remember a time we had moved to the 610 group, and we were in that stage that we thought everybody needed to be there for the people. And they couldn't play poker in this club, but they could watch television. And Bob didn't like it, and I didn't either, when a newcomer would come in. And the guys would just sit there watching television and wouldn't pay any attention to the newcomers. So we talked to Horace about that. That was one of our problems. And he said, we were at a state conference in Dallas at the time. And Horace said, you see all these people in this room? And we said, yes, we did. And he said, everybody is in a different stage of recovery. And everyone doesn't see things alike. Especially when they're in a different stage of recovery. And he said, just don't pay any attention to them. You just get up and talk to the new members and let them go ahead and watch TV. But the time will come, if they grow, that they will outgrow that stage, and then they will be ready to help another. Horace Fort told us lots of, I call them pearls or truths. He said the AA, the AA program is put in a capsule form. The AA program is composed of all the truths of the world put in a capsule form, simple enough for the alcoholic to swallow. That's a real pearl to me. And I have remembered it and quoted it and passed it on to many different people. Al-Anon didn't have sponsors until some years later. I had teachers. I called them my teachers. Jack Bowling was one of my teachers. Horace Fort was one of my teachers. And then I heard this woman in AA talk, and she just spoke to my soul. And I asked her to be my sponsor. She's the one, and I took a fifth step with her, and it was at Brownwood, Texas, that I did that. Her name was Marion Forbes. I'm sure you remember, Roy. After I did the fifth step with her, she said, now, my dear, it is time for you to learn to meditate. And I had been trying, but I just didn't know how to do that very well. There weren't any books on it or anyone doing it. And so she had me get some books and sent me some tapes, and I learned to meditate, and I learned to listen, and I learned to follow the guidance. And with that, my life got so good. I think I've been in the program maybe 12 or 14 years, and everything in my world was better than anything I could have dreamed. There's a line in the big book that I love. Both you and the new person must walk day by day down the path of spiritual progress, and if you persist, remarkable things will happen. When you look back, you will see that the things you put in God's hands turned out far better than anything you could ever dream. Follow the dictates of your higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world. All those things that happened to me, all the promises had come true. And one day, I was so full of it. I was so full of the joy and the delight and the gratitude that I just said, oh, God, I love you so much. I love you so much. And then I got real quiet, and I said, now what can I do for you? And I made a commitment that day to God that I would listen. And I could hear that still, small voice sometimes, and I would listen. And I would put that first. And I had already been told that God was a lot easier to please than people. And I had found that out, and I wanted to please God rather than people. It was just perfect for me to do that. And it was something that was spontaneous, that came from my soul. And that was the beginning. Now, I had done the steps. I had washed the coffee cups. I had cleaned the club. I had done meetings. Sometimes it wasn't easy. Sometimes it was fun. Just call somebody or write them a letter. And when anything would come into my consciousness when I was meditating, I knew that I could tell the difference. And I had reached the point that I could spiritually discern what was from me, Marcy, and what was from God. And so I would write those things down, and I'd do them. And the most wonderful things have unfolded as a result of me listening and following the guidance. People didn't understand. Sometimes they talked about me. And it was okay. It was just the way it was. And God was first in my life. I have followed that all these years to the best of my ability. Maybe sometimes I might not hear it, but if I heard it and I knew it was mine to do, I would do it. We have a message and an experience in this spiritual way of life and program that puts us head and shoulders around anybody else. When we have that, we can walk through anything we need to walk through and do anything we need to do. And Don talked about that this morning. You're never alone. And anything that we need to do, we just do it. And in that spiritual experience, lots of things unfolded. One was I had to look at myself again, and I had to get deeper into the steps. And with that looking, I was able to take my eyes off of these people out here, especially him, and look within. And with that, I was able to release Bob in a way that I had never been able to release him before. See, I always thought that he didn't have enough sense to come in out of the rain, but the things he did when he was drunk, and it didn't seem to me he was a lot better when he got sober for a while. So I tried to help him. And we would go on a trip, and I'd take the big book, and I'd read him the big book. And then, this is one of the worst things I ever did, I'm sure. Henry, Bob's sponsor, got drunk. And everybody told us Henry was drunk. And I said, Bob, you've got to go see Henry. He wouldn't go. I went to see Henry. I made a trust up call. And I was mad at him. Because, see, I guess I was sort of sheltered in the program, but I didn't know people got drunk after they got sober. I just didn't know they did. And I thought, how could he do that? What's the matter with you? And I went over there in a rage, and Anna Merle was gone, and I said, Henry, I just have a few questions to ask you. Oh, what's that? I said, well, I want to know, before you took that first drink, did you make your contract with God that morning? And he said, oh, I don't think I did. And I said, and I want to know, did you do your third step? Have you done your fourth step and your fifth step? Well, I don't think I do. I just started did 1 and 12, and I just never did any of those steps very good. I said, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. The very idea of you working with people and working with Bob, and then you get drunk and look what you've done. And I just went on and on. And then he tried to tell me that Anna Merle was trying to kill him. I said, you're a liar. And he said, she's trying to starve me to death. She won't give me any food, and all I can do is run in the kitchen when she's gone and swallow a raw egg. I said, Henry, I do not believe that. I won't say the word I said, but I didn't believe it. And Henry told me later that he could not wait for me to leave so he could have another drink. But I want you to know that Henry stayed sober the rest of his life too. I don't think he wanted me making another 12-step call on him. But after I got into my spiritual journey, I quit doing all those ridiculous things. And I calmed down a little bit, and I got a little quieter, and I listened, and I did follow the guidance. And one of the things that I learned in my spiritual walk was, and some of you call it the committee in your head, I called it my lower self and my higher self. And when I would be in meditation, I would be in my high self, and I would see all these things, and I would be told these things, and it seemed real easy when I was up here, you know, in meditation. But then I would come down into this plane, and it wasn't so easy to do. And what I realized was that my higher self and my lower self were kind of at warfare with each other, and my lower self usually won. And my lower self would always talk me out of doing those things that God wanted me to do. And it would say things like, well, what would he think? They'll talk about you if you do that. And they won't like you. They won't understand. And I heard all this stuff, and it would talk me out of doing all the things. I could look back at my life and see that many of the things that Spirit or God was trying to get me to do, my lower self would talk me out of that. Now, people have a lot of names for that, the committee. Now, what I did with the committee, when I was had my little pad and I was listening and writing things down, if I had something that I needed to do that day, like go to the grocery store or the cleaners or buy a pound of coffee or whatever it was, mind didn't stay on those things. Then my mind got clear so I could listen. And that was one of the great truths that I learned in learning how to meditate and keep the mind still. Everybody has a busy mind. But to get the mind still, and write those things down, then we're free to listen and follow the guidance. I have quite a few little things I wrote down because people have asked me for lists. And somebody asked me about my untreated Al-Anonism. And this morning, I got up and I suggested to George, he was sitting on the bed looking at the lake, and I said, why don't you turn that chair around and sit and look at the lake? And he said, there you go with your untreated Al-Anonism again. And then Steve said, have you added to your list? And I said, well, you know, I don't think I have. But I found my list. And the way I came up with this untreated Al-Anonism, I was listening to Paul M. at a state conference in, I think it was Austin, and he talked about untreated alcoholism. And he said, if you're suffering from fear, resentment, if you're wanting to drink, if you don't love people around you, and he named a bunch of things, you're suffering from untreated alcoholism. So I sat there and interpreted it. Well, I guess I'm suffering from untreated Al-Anonism. I'd had a daughter that I had been with that had died, and I hadn't gotten over that yet, and I was sad. I didn't know where I was going. I had a void in my life, and I wasn't in a good place when I heard him talk. But I went around to people and asked them, what is untreated Al-Anonism? Nobody could tell me. So I decided I'm going to have to find out for myself. That's the way I had to do most things. I've asked, for years I asked people, what are the principles of the program? Nobody could tell me. And so I had to find out what they were. So I've got a list of principles of the program up here, and I've got my untreated Al-Anonism. Self-righteousness, being a martyr, knowing best, blind spots, low self-image, resentments, complaining, blaming, self-involvement, fear, false pride, frustration, being a fixer, that was a good one for me, depression, intolerance, anger, people pleaser, perfectionist, knowing best, a mistaken sense of responsibility, reacting. Then I wrote, Al-Anonism is a disease of the mind. Then I've got hurt feelings, critical, lonely, low self-esteem, frozen inside, reacting rather than responding, false pride, selfishness, self-centeredness, and self-pity. Now, Steve, if you've got more than that, well, you can see me after the meeting, and I'll add to my list. And some of the, one of the things I learned about working the steps that I would like to pass on to you, because it really made a difference when I learned to work the steps this way. I wasn't new in the program when I did this, but after I'd been in the program probably 10 or 12 years, we started in Midland a meeting for AAs and Al-Anons together called an all-together meeting. And we did a step each week. And one week we would have an Al-Anon chairman, and next week an AA chairman. And I really wanted to look good when I was called on, so I studied the steps. And I read them, and I worked them, and I lived them, and that was really good for me. But after I had done it that way, then I realized that if we take anything, a step, a slogan, anything we're working on, and we live it and breathe it and apply it and make it first in our life, if we do that for 3 weeks, then it goes from the conscious mind to the subconscious mind, and then we don't have to think about doing it. It becomes ours. We make it ours. And when I went through the steps that way, and I worked on a step maybe a week or two, and then I might pick up the next step, but I would be doing the second one solely for maybe a couple of weeks, but then I would still be doing the first step. And when I took my time and went through the steps that way, they became my second nature. That's just the way it works in our life when we take the time to do those things and give it everything we've got. We gave our life out there everything and almost ruined our lives, so now we've got to turn it around and put that same energy but in a positive way. Another thing that I learned to do during my spiritual journey was always look for the positive things in people and look through the stuff that I didn't like and look through to their real essence or who they really were and love them like they were. And that might have been the beginning of unconditional love for me, because I remember one morning I was meditating, and this was an era, I don't know whether this comes and goes or not, but this was an era in Midland that everyone was telling everybody what was wrong with them. And I didn't want to do that. And I said out loud to God one day as I was meditating, God, I don't want to do that. I don't like to tell people what's the matter with them. Do I have to do that? And the answer came, no. No, you don't have to do that. You just love them, and you encourage them, and you give them a pat on the back, and when they need to know, they will see it themselves. I said, oh, thank you. I can do that. And that's what I started doing, and that was fun to do. And that sort of works into, let me see how far I, oh, I'm, that just works out perfect. That from that was the beginning of what I call giving people the blessing. It just happened that I had grown up enough in the program that I gave myself permission to do some spiritual things that I wanted to do. And I got my sponsor, and we went to a five-day retreat at Lathy Lodge in the hill country of Texas. And it wasn't an AA Al-Anon deal. It was just a spiritual retreat. And I heard this man talk about the blessing. He was a minister, and he counseled ministers. And he said that every time anyone came into his office for him to counsel, the first question he would ask was, are you a blessed child? Nobody even knows whether they're blessed or not. But he said that it was our birthright to be blessed. And he gave lots of scriptures. Abraham was the blessed son of Isaac, and Isaac and Jacob was the blessed son of, I get them all mixed up, but it's Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and it goes down the line, and they were all blessed. And it is our birthright to be blessed by our parents. If we're not blessed by our parents, we go out into life an emotional cripple. And where do you suppose we look for the blessing? In the booze and sex, food, fast cars, anything we can get to fill up this hole that we have inside. And I listened to that man, and I was reliving my life as I heard him talk. He also said, and if you can't get the blessing from your parents, remember that they can't give away something that they haven't received. If they haven't received the blessing, they can't give it to you. And quit going back to the dry hole. It can ruin your life. And I began to look at my life and realize that my father was a practicing alcoholic, and my mother was worried about him, and I didn't feel like I ever had the blessing from my parents. I had it from my grandmother. And then I looked at my husband, and he was a black sheep of the family, and he certainly didn't get the blessing. And here these two young people fall in love and get married, and I wanted the blessing from him, and he wanted the blessing from me, and we couldn't give it to each other because we had never received it. And then I looked at my life in the program and realized I was doing that. I was giving the blessing. When we make amends, we're given the blessing. When we look at ourselves and see the errors that we've made and we want to make those right for ourselves and for others, that's part of the blessing. The program, living the program is a blessing. We come to meetings and we get the blessing. people accept us and love us like we are. And I really believe that's one of the things that keeps us coming back, because we're approved of, we are loved, and we are blessed when we come to meetings. Nobody puts us down. We're accepted just like we are. As this man kept talking, my mind just kept going back to my children and my mother and my father. And though I had done it sort of, and I had things were okay with my father before he died. I want to tell you very briefly that when I went into the program, I hated my father and what he had done to me and my mother, and they told me to pray for him. And I prayed for my father every day, whether I meant it or not. Sometimes I really meant it and said, God, please send somebody to help my dad. He needs it. And sometimes I'd say, God bless him. He sure does need it. But I prayed a prayer every day for my father. And God saw fit that I was in the right place at the right time when my father asked for help. And I got to carry him the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to see him sober. And I got to watch the miracles and see his life change. I saw the fears drop away. I saw him get interested in people. I saw him really caring. I saw him wake up. And it was the most wonderful thing. I did not get to see that with Bob. He was over there and I was over here. But with my father, I got to see it. And we talked each day on the phone, and we read the 24-hour book, and we would talk about it. And he'd ask me about Millie and this one and this one and this one. And he was sober a year. And I happened to be at Lake Whitney when this happened, and I was grateful that I didn't see him drunk again. But he started drinking. He had hurt his leg, and he couldn't go to meetings, and he had to walk, and he was too proud to ask anybody to come get him. And it was a hot summer day, and he decided that a beer wouldn't hurt him. I think it's in the little red book that says that stinking thinking leads to drinking. And that's what happened to him. And he started drinking beer. He graduated to vodka in 2 months. In 2 weeks, my father had died practicing alcoholic. When my mother called and told me what had happened, the first thing I said was, "That's okay, Daddy. You don't have to drink anymore." And my mother said that he was different on this last run, that he wasn't demanding, he wasn't hollering, he just laid in bed peacefully and just drank and went on. But we'd mended the fences, and I was okay with that. And then I had some wonderful experiences with the spirit of my father coming to me later that I don't have time to go into. But when we clean up our lives, and we get rid of the junk and the stuff, you know, it affects the generation before us and the generation after us. So that's three generations that get cleared. And if we keep on doing this, the world is going to be okay, because the buck stops when we tend to ourselves and the generation before us and the generation after us. It makes all the difference in the world, in our lives and in their lives. So don't think just because you're not out doing this and that you're not living and doing the way God wants you to. Because when we live our life according to the 12-step program, and we listen and we follow the guidance, we all have assignments, and they're all different. But when we're true to ourselves and we follow that and we're true to God, we're changed, we're transformed, and we're different. And when we are that way, then Spirit will use us in the most wonderful ways. I wish I had time to tell you the ways, but I'm just going to talk about the blessing just a little bit longer, and then we're going to close. The blessing is a simple thing. It's mending the fences. It's making amends. It's just going the second mile, turning the other cheek. The blessing is doing something you don't want to do with someone that they're out here in your life, and you're hurt, and you don't want to do it, but you do it anyway, don't you? And it works. That's the wonderful thing. We're the ones that have the magic. We're the holders of the magic. We're the ones that have the miracles. So So because we have been blessed, and if we didn't get blessed by our parents, we get blessed in AA and Al-Anon, and we get blessed by God. And when that happens, we can do these things that we never had the courage or the stamina or the know-how to do. We just do them. And it's amazing when we begin to do them how Spirit helps us. When we do the things that we need to do on a daily basis, that opens up the way for God to drop the blessings in upon us. And when we have those blessings dropped in upon us and our cup is filled and we give from the overflow, then we can be a blessing to everyone we touch, everyone we see, everyone we meet. And it's simple things like this. Meaningful touch. Just holding another in your arms or giving them a hug. A spoken message from your heart. Being intimate with someone. Just opening up and being honest. Letting the person know we value them, that we have high esteem for them. This is wonderful for your children and people you sponsor. And unconditional acceptance. Isn't that what we've always wanted? Just love us and accept us like we are. Picturing a special future for the one you are blessing and communicating it to them. Like, CJ, I see you just being the best teacher and having a wonderful outlook in your life and for all those children that you touch. Just simple things like that. Continuing to support the person with positive thoughts, words, and actions. Using understanding and tolerance, practicing the principles of the program. Releasing with love is a blessing. Leaving people free to live their life, and we don't know best. We don't even need to think we know best. God knows best. And leaving them free to find their way. Loving for fun and for free, without an expectation. To be aware and open to our true selves is the greatest blessing. When we are blessed, all those around us participate in the blessing, and we hold it sacred in our hearts. As I've said, we are the holders of the magic and the miracles. And when we continue to do what is ours to do, the miracles happen and continue to happen. And as we're doing this, we can practice the principles of honesty, surrender, acceptance, faith, trust, courage, responsibility, integrity, humility, willingness, loving, patience, service, awareness, serenity, action, and gratitude. That's some of the principles that we find in the 12 steps of the program. And when we get antsy and when we get fearful and when we get resentful and those things start coming back, we know that it's time to look and see where we've missed the mark. And that's just a little warning, just a little flag. When we get that way, it's time to look. What am I not practicing? What am I not doing that I need to do to be okay again? And we can catch it just like that if we stay awake and aware and listen to that still small voice and follow that guidance. And sometimes it takes courage. But it is the most delightful journey that I could have ever imagined, and then some. And I didn't even want to be here. I didn't even want to come. If we aren't the silliest things to think that we're going to get our way and we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we don't have a clue what's best for us. We're just like little unruly kids that are going to school on this earth plane, and we have lessons to learn and things to do, and we can all do it together. I love you all. Thank you.